The CEO Roundtable brings together operations professionals at the top of their game to define and explore what it means to be highly effective in a scale-up organization. And what sits at the heart of it is highly curated peer-to-peer roundtables where COOs talk about things that matter.
I absolutely love my roundtable. We've been together for about 2 years, and without exaggeration, I have made friends for life.
To find out more, go to COOroundtable.com. That's COOroundtable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Operations Room, a podcast for COOs. I am Brandon Mensinga, joined by my amazing co-host, Bethany Ayers. How are things going?
They are going really well, Brandon, because this weekend I booked our summer holiday.
So in the depths of February, not that it's particularly cold here, but you have booked the sunshine and sunlight of a summer vacation.
But even more than that is we are splitting our time between the French Alps and Alicante again. So I booked flights for three of us, London to Geneva, Geneva to Alicante, and then all four of us, Alicante back to London, and spent in total £367.
Wow.
Yeah. And it includes like actual checked in luggage. So BA miles. And the flight between Geneva and Alicante is on EasyJet, and EasyJet has a sale right now. And so it was like 200 and something for the three of us. We're going to the same flat that we stayed in Alicante last time. So know everything, has sorted out the hire car already. So all I have to do now is decide where we stay in the French Alps, and we're done.
Well, congratulations. I went back to Canada last week for two nights, if you can imagine. So it felt like a whirlwind trip a little bit. And actually, equally, I got a round trip ticket to Toronto for £420. No checked baggage, because I didn't need checked baggage for the two nights, but that's a fabulous price.
I can't imagine that for two nights. It's a huge flight.
I know. It's 8 hours. So I lucked out just in terms of the seating scenario. It was rather punishing, I would say, on the time zone differences. So we've got a phenomenal topic today, which is how do you scale from 100 employees to IPO? And we've got the man that's done it. It's Mark Logan. He's the ex-CEO of Skyscanner. He, in fact, came in at roughly 100 employees and took them all the way through IPO. And I'm sure that's why he's now received his OB, FRSE designations, part of the Queen's Council, whatever those things are. And we will talk to him in a little while. But before we get to that, Bethany, just a bit of a back and forth between ourselves. So the first one that he talked about was investing in individual competence and just making sure that every single employee in the business is set up for success within their roles. What's your view on number one here, which is investing in individual competence?
It's essential for two reasons. One is people need to be able to do their jobs well, and everything is changing so quickly nowadays that you can't just rely on hiring somebody that has a degree in it, because chances are their degree is already obsolete. And so you actually have to help people stay up with the skills that they need. And this year is a perfect example. How are you going to learn about Gen AI? And you need those skills in your business. And then the second one is just around retention and motivated employees. Everybody wants to develop and learn, or nearly everyone. I don't want to generalize to 100% want to develop and learn and feel like they're relevant, and therefore investing in their ability to learn is paramount to retaining staff and having a happy employee base.
I was reading some article the other day around wellness programs, and it occurred to me that this is a bit of a controversial view here, but if you're going to allocate budget for things, I would prefer to allocate money into line management effectiveness and career development as opposed to wellness programs, because at the end of the day, you need to build the basics and get the basics in place before you start optimizing. And optimizing is things like wellness, in my view.
I don't really understand what a wellness budget is. So I think it would depend on what's in that budget. I think the reason why companies don't get career development right is because they think it's outside training or training programs. And that's only a small piece of the puzzle. And sometimes, like where we are right now, there aren't outside training programs that are actually good or structured or created yet because it's all so new. And some of it is actually either giving people the time at work to develop themselves, or like the permission, because people feel like, and I certainly used to do this, of like, I can only read on my time. I can only watch videos on my time. I can only think on my time. Business time is to do. And then by the time it's thinking time, I was exhausted. So actually giving myself permission to think in work time, and therefore giving the people who report to me and cascading down the permission to think at work, because actually your doing isn't valuable. Your thinking and learning is. So part of it is carving out the time and the permission. But the other part is recognizing and encouraging people who do make the effort to learn and celebrating that learning. I think people feel it's like the responsibility to create a workshop and everybody attends that workshop, or we hire in a trainer and everybody attends that training. But then people forget about it. It's not part of the business and everybody does. So how do you create a learning environment? And that's where the career progression comes in. And then you can still spend on wellness, whatever wellness programs are.
So I completely agree with that, because even very simple things where behaviorally you're wanting to do and try different behaviors within the organization to flex yourself, to start growing yourself in certain directions. So purely as an example, I was challenged with giving more recognition to individuals and to teams on a weekly basis. And I was being held to account to that in terms of like, Brandon, have you done it? Right. So if you think back on the past week, how many times did you give proper recognition or reward either to an individual or to a team? And the answer sometimes was zero. So I'm like, yes, I am clearly not doing it. So that behavioral push, I consider this to be hands-on, practical in the business, things that matter week to week that from a career standpoint are tremendously important to my craft and things that I was learning how to do in this case. Second point. So he talked a lot about alignment and this kind of situation where you need to have some level of structure and process to create alignment, but you don't want to overdo it.
That's 100% where the art versus the science comes in. It's like the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. And I feel like oftentimes with OKRs, everybody gets really into the letter of the law and it becomes like a Bible and rules and challenges and failures, even if you've succeeded because you haven't done it in exactly the way that you were supposed to have done it. And really what we need to be focusing on is like the spirit of why we're doing things. What are actually the most important things? What is the context behind that? And then just constantly reminding and keeping that drumbeat of remembering that these are the three most important things for the business this year. Everything needs to fall within those three, but you don't need to like tight-handedly grasp onto it all. We worked with Nike, and Nike does this really well. They have like three OKRs. They were major strategic initiatives. Every single person at Nike could tell you what the three were and how their bit of what they were doing fit into one of those three, but not in like my three KPIs link perfectly to somebody else's three KPIs at the top, but more trusting that everybody understood the context, were good at their jobs, and understood the strategy and therefore could advance the strategy wherever they were in the business. And that's what Mark's talking about.
Yeah, love that. Point number three that Mark spoke about was access to resources, making sure primarily they have the right folks in play to be able to accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish. What's your view on number three?
So this is where product teams and agile get it right. They're self-forming multidisciplinary teams that can get everything done that needs doing. I think that works well if you know what needs doing. What's hard is when something pops up and you need to like self-form a new team, which means that you need to be able to somehow unform a previous team. And so like the theory of it sounds great. The reality of what happens when you need to change and get people moving and restructured quickly is difficult. The other thing that he wasn't talking about, but I do find is a challenge, particularly I found this as a CRO, is people thinking they need resource when they don't. So when the resource is another person or a skill, the way that Mark is talking, totally get it. when somebody feels like they need a new piece of technology, otherwise they can't do their job. I am much more cynical. And sometimes it's true, but we need to figure it out and know how we're going to use that technology. And other times it has just not been thought through at all. And it's just like a panacea. And so again, it comes into the expertise of leadership to understand and filter through and question and figure out what are actual constraints and what are imaginary constraints.
Just out of curiosity, what's the criteria by which you would accept kind of a technology request? I was thinking about this the other day based on one of our previous podcasts, and you said something interesting to me, which kind of stuck in my head. And it's really this idea that that person that's requesting that piece of technology, they already need to have a very clear process in place that they've refined over time, where they have absolute clarity as to how it actually works right now. And when they go into that new tooling, they know exactly how it's going to be different and better.
You should use technology when you understand how it's going to make your life better, how it's going to make it faster, or how you can't do something because you don't have it. But it needs to be really defined and clear. And I don't think it needs to be a perfect business case. So it's like, I'm going to spend £10,000 and therefore I'm going to have £10,000 worth of like freed up space or generate £10,000 more leads, because very rarely does it fit in so perfectly, particularly in startups or in scale ups where we're not dealing with magnitudes, where like 10 minutes saved on everybody turns into millions. We're not in that like world yet.
Point number four, last one that Mark brought up, was ownership, or who owns the decision, and having boundaries as well. What's your take on this one?
I was talking to a friend recently who is not in a tech scale-up. He is in a security real business with people, not just technology, and has not come from a business background. He's the CEO. And the structure of the company is fascinating. And he's basically done what Mark is advocating accidentally. And so they have these pods with a manager leader set of analysts who can work independently, who make all of the decisions around the projects that they're delivering. But he feels like his job as CEO and the two things he should spend all of his time in is winning new business and making sure that everybody remembers why they're doing, why the business exists. And that was just such a freeing concept. He's like, I really thought I was going to be a command and control leader. I thought I was going to want to know everything, but like, I just can't. I don't want to, and it bores me. And so he's like, because of the way he's interested, he's pushed all of that decision-making power very low in the organization. And what that's meant is they don't have any bottlenecks as they scale.
With that, let's go on a quick break. And when we come back, we have our conversation with Mr. Mark Logan. What are the foundations of scale? And you can imagine that, you know, for Bethany and I, being in Series A companies and Series B companies, we think a tremendous amount about this question of how you scale organizations effectively. So when you think about this broad-based question of what are the foundations of scale, what's your take on that?
My firm view is that the foundation for scale is agency. And what I mean by that is, as a company grows, in the early days, the company's staff has had very high agency. You know, the founders and who joined shortly after, they know what they're trying to build. They know how the customer feels. They know what they own. They know what they're responsible for, and they can just get on with it. And many founders look back wistfully on those early years and lament how it's just not the same anymore. The trick is, as the company scales, that same sense of the agency to do things, it needs to move to the front line of the organization as the front line moves away from the founders. You know, the front line being where the actual work is done, where customers are met, bugs are fixed, products are released, markets are marketed to. So the key concept for me is always, what's the level of agency of the frontline staff of the business? And what you find is that in almost every startup, all things being equal, as the company grows, you know, as headcount gets increased, the level of agency that individuals have left its own devices drops, and actually drops quite rapidly until it provokes a productivity crisis. So I think if we focus our organizational design efforts as, you know, operations people, as COOs and as founders, etc., on the notion of, if you could measure it, what's your agency index on day one? Let's say it's 100. And then why isn't it still 100 on day 365 or afterwards? That's the North Star that I try to steer the ship by.
It's definitely the nirvana of businesses that I've always wanted to work in, regardless of seniority or level, you know, because obviously if you're at the front line and you have loads of agency, that's a great place to work. As we get bigger, it never seems to stay. And we try lots of different things and lots of giving context and policies that are around guidelines and principles rather than rules and contracts. And yet with rapid growth, I feel like command and control sneaks in no matter how much you don't want it to. How do you manage to actually keep that agency going?
Let's first of all try to define agency a bit better, because it's in that definition that the answer, the seeds of the answer to that question exist, Beth. And it's probably useful to contrast agency with autonomy. They're not the same thing. You can be autonomous and incompetent, for example. And it's that fear of autonomous incompetency that often makes executives and founders reluctant to really explore this concept. So I think of agency as consisting of a number of things. The first is that you've got to have the basic competence to do the job that's in front of you. Now, that seems like an obvious statement, but think about the fact that as an organization grows, the competency of everybody drops, all things being equal. So for example, I'm very good at managing two people, but suddenly I've got 10 people and I'm actually incompetent at that, and the organization hasn't invested in that competence. So competency goes off over time unless it's very actively invested in. So one reason the agency falls is because companies don't invest sufficiently actively in competence. They assume it's a sort of given. I should say, as an aside, the person or people that most affects are founders. And, you know, founders tend to give themselves a free pass because, you know, I'm a product visionary. I leave small things like management technique to others because I'm a visionary. For most staff in a business, the company will grow without you if you don't grow with it. In the case of CEOs, that's not the case. The company will become shackled to your level of incompetence if the company's growing and you're not growing with it. So there are no free passes for founders, although often founders would like to think there was. You're not special, so don't think you are. The next thing is ownership. Now, if we three of us started a company, we would all be very clear what we owned. You know, like one of us would be the VP of engineering, one marketing, one sales, whatever. So we know what we own. But if you join a company as employee 200, for example, you often find that even despite your job title, you don't actually have clear boundaries on what you own. You know, how often have we seen a situation where, you know, you've been hired to be the customer success manager, but then you find out that Jeff on floor two thinks he owns a bit of that as well. And right from the outset, you've got to negotiate, you know, before you could even start doing things. So if we don't push ownership out to the front line and clearly delineate it, that tends to cause noise. And I'm always staggered at, you know, what we hold on to as senior people. An analogy I'd give you, which I think works quite well, is let's imagine that in our private lives, the three of us decided to start a book club, for example. We'd come up with a kind of theme, we'd pick some books, we'd invite some friends, we'd find one of our houses to run it. And what we wouldn't do is go to the Prime Minister and ask if we can have a book club. But in a startup or in a growing company, that's effectively what people do. You know, I have seen the case where someone says, should we start a book club? And someone says, yeah, let's go and ask the HR if that's okay. Or let's see what the founder thinks, you know, is she happy with these types of books? So what we need to do to get ownership scaling is consciously push things out to the front line that ought to be owned by the front line, and obviously reserve certain matters like deep strategy, et cetera, more centrally. But it's so easy to get that wrong. When I joined Skyscanner, for example, my first management meeting, item number one was, should we buy company X, which is a question that management should deal with. Item number two was, should we give out free luggage tags that say Skyscanner on them in the Edinburgh airport? Which, you know, simply because founders had been used to making those decisions in the past and had forgotten to do the hard work to give people the confidence to know that they owned those decisions. It sounds absurd in retrospect, but it's a super, super common issue. The third aspect of agency is alignment. And this is a subtle one, this, because we all understand what we mean when we say, oh, the company doesn't have a sufficient strategic alignment. So Beth and Brandon, you set the strategy as the founders, but I don't really know what that strategy is or how it relates to my work. And you don't really know if I'm aligned, therefore you can't really trust me. So what are we going to do? So that's a very common issue. And of course, the response to it is a number of ceremonies in place to assure alignment. But in doing so, we essentially remove agency beyond a certain tipping point, because we sometimes put so much bureaucracy around alignment that we spend our time operating the bureaucracy rather than using it to enable what we're trying to do. So it's very easy to get alignment wrong in both directions. And I think the final way we take agency away from people is we deny them access to the necessary resources to do the job they have to do. I don't mean from a kind of headcount, we need more people perspective. It's usually, oh, I need access to a designer. Well, the designer's busy. You can put your thing in a queue until they're ready. 3 weeks go by, you still can't get access to the designer. So you're essentially, you've lost agency. So in designing an organization that scales for agency, you have to think of those four areas and you consciously take steps regularly as organization grows to restore agency in those areas, I believe.
Just on the alignment part of things, you said it could go wrong in both ways. Can you maybe just like dive into that a little bit in terms of things that you've seen that don't make sense and maybe some not best practices, but tricks of the trade of how to get that right?
Yes, certainly. So I'll give you a concrete example from my own experience again at Skyscanner. So in our early days, you know, of course, like every other startup, we suddenly realized that, hey, there's 100 people in this company now, and we haven't really gone to the effort to ensure that everybody's working on things that align to the strategy sufficiently. So we did those things that everybody does, which is write down goals for the company and talk about them. So that's a sensible thing to do. So let's imagine, if you will, that as you know, what we've just done there is moved along the agency axis and increased the benefit from doing that, the net benefit of that effort. And then we said, well, you know, that's working well. So really all the major teams should have goals which explicitly align to those objectives. So we put that in place. We moved further along the agency axis. We got further net benefit. It didn't cost as much to do, and it was very helpful to build confidence that people were working on the right things so we could trust them with more agency. And then, of course, we said, well, let's do that again. This time, let's make sure all the sub-teams of the major teams have goals as well. You know, we've all done this journey. We've all gone on this journey. And then we said, well, you know, we should probably make sure that people's individual objectives align. And so we've done the whole cascade. And then we said, well, we really need to ensure that they stay aligned. So at the start of the quarter, we'll get each of the team leaders to present to the senior management what they're working on to show that alignment. We can adjust it, catch things if it's not aligned. Of course, that required a slide pack, which people built. That caused over time senior people at me to say, you know, it'd be great if we could also add in this graph and that chart just so we can get a better view. Common mistake is to burden the organization for the convenience of the executives, not realizing the consequences of that. Then we did the same thing at the end of the quarter to make sure they had done the things that they said they would do. And then eventually this became quite cumbersome. So we hired essentially, this wasn't their job title, but a project manager for alignment. And of course, that person wants to create a full job. So they started to innovate. And every night, team leaders would type in the percentage complete in their OKRs into a tool, which meant people like me get a real-time update on progress. Felt great. And then one day we realized that we were getting less done than before. And, you know, you could probably guess why that was. The goal for the team had become operating the bureaucracy, not completing the tasks that the bureaucracy is designed to support. So it's like a kind of, you know, those economic Laffer curves, as they call them. For a while, you're getting more net benefit, but eventually the net cost outweighs the net benefit. That's a super common pathology. It's not the only one, but I think it illustrates the issue. So essentially, too little and too much alignment take away agency, which takes away the point of having people in the first place. You've got to get it in the middle, and that's trial and error, but you've got to know that's what you're trying to do.
And I think as COOs, there's a real, like just in personalities, it's very logical that a cascade should work. And it feels really good to have a spreadsheet. And it's really good to see what's going on. But my experience has been the same, where you get much less going on. Somehow you don't even end up with as much alignment, because you end up in these like compromises and people who just have pet projects that they want to do and almost become lawyers to justify how that pet project is actually going to be part of this goal. And I think what it highlights is not taking the time to really explain, not just like in the ceremonies or the quarterly meetings, these are OKRs, but to enable each level of management so that those managers know what actually is going on and what makes sense and buy into the strategy.
That's absolutely true. It's very related to the issue that inexperienced managers and senior managers believe that management's about control, but it's not about control, it's about enablement and it's about influence. And if you try to make it about control, then you end up smothering the energy of people by your control mechanisms. Hierarchies are necessary, functional hierarchies are necessary in businesses for certain reasons, but that reason shouldn't be to exert control through the layers. I think instead, if people are really clear what the objectives are and they're sufficiently competent to hold the responsibility for meeting those, that's the ideal. It's interesting, you've heard the old cliche that if no plan survives contact with the enemy, modern military forces from, you know, the 1900s onwards have absolutely embraced that idea, and they've ensured that their local commanders on the ground can improvise and innovate to meet the goals of the business. But we don't tend to have embraced that in business to the same extent. And we encourage people who want to be creative to almost behave dysfunctionally in order to carry out their projects. We need a different approach, and it starts with my job is to enable and influence, and your job is then to fulfill the goals based on those powers. That's the contract we should have with our people.
I also feel as though in the last 15 years, that's basically been the goal of me and many of the people that I've worked with. And yet, when you start to scale rapidly, it seems to break. And I don't know why. So I'd like you to tell me why and how we can fix it.
I think partly the reason is that we neglect one of those four corners of what agency is. So for example, when we scale very quickly, we're almost certainly not managing for competence, except in retrospect. We're almost certainly doing a poor job on relentless communication, you know, the goals of the business and alignment. We're almost certainly got real fuzziness around who owns what and what they have authority to do. And we almost certainly create fiefdoms and competition between managers to have bigger teams and barriers between them. One other area to bring in, which I think is relevant here, is how many networks do you have in your business? Now, we don't tend to think about the networks in our business in those terms. We tend to think about, we've got an org chart and that ought to be able to get the job done. And org charts appear scalable. You know, you can always attach people to a node in an org chart. So let's say that, just as a thought experiment here, that we had taken care to a sufficient extent of those areas of agency I was talking about earlier. So that's reasonably in shape. But let's say that we then over-index on the importance of the functional hierarchy. So what are functional hierarchies good at? Giving people a place to land in an organization, give them a job title, appraise them, performance review them, etc. They're not very good at implementing the what I would call the golden processes of the business. What are the golden processes? Well, for example, delivering your service on a daily basis, whatever that service may be. Secondly, is acquiring customers to experience that service. You know, that's an end-to-end thing. That's two. And the third gold process is the work that goes in to improve the first two, releasing product and all that sort of stuff. Now, functional hierarchies, if that's your only mechanism to execute, then they cut right across those three processes. They actually build walls between them, because each of these processes, let's take, for example, customer acquiring and maintaining those relationships. That's about acquisition. It's about activating me into a habit around your product. It's about maintaining that habit, monetizing me, encouraging me to refer other people. In that summary, I've just covered, I need salespeople, marketing people, data scientists, engineers, testers, product managers. And if you've divided those all conveniently up into different functions, you're essentially putting walls all the way along that process. So when we scale very rapidly, if we're using the functional hierarchy as our sole network in a business, the scaling creates ever more what I call symmetry. It's like, well, Beth, you're in product management, I'm in engineering, Brandon's in sales. Let's see if we can schedule a meeting 3 weeks from now, and I can't do that Tuesday. Can you do it? I can't do the Wednesday. Eventually we get the meeting, we bring our flags on the table and we discuss why we're having trouble acquiring customers. So I think it's important that a growing organization answers the question of how do you subordinate everything to the golden processes? And that requires you to have a different additional structure that's at least a peer of the functional hierarchy. Neither of those things, by the way, a task-oriented network or a functional network, neither of them are good at innovation beyond incremental innovation. The functional hierarchy, for example, tends to say, we innovate at 3:30 on a Friday where we have our innovation meeting. And I don't think that's how Leonardo da Vinci went about it, for example. So you've really got to have three networks in your business. One for innovation, which is relatively informal and spontaneous. One for the execution of your key tasks or your key processes. And one which manages the hierarchy of people and gives them identity. But most businesses only focus on one. And that limitation has shown up very, very quickly as you scale quickly.
The functional we all get, the cross-functional or the task orientation or the golden process orientation, some companies are good at this, other companies are not. We get that as operations professionals in terms of we play a significant role in making that happen. The innovation one that you talked about, I'm very interested in that. Can you kind of unpack that in terms of what should that look like? What are the trappings of that to unleash that?
So innovation needs two things. It needs wiggle room, or you could say time. And it also needs the clashing of different skill sets. Now, there's two ways to clash different skill sets. One is that you somehow find different ways to informally bring different functions together. The famous water cooler, lunch hall, or modern day equivalents of that. But you've got to really actively encourage those relationships. So that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to make your people what I'd call T-shaped. If you think about the letter T, think of the vertical part of that T as the depth of your specialism, and think of the horizontal part on the top as your knowledge of adjacent skill areas. It's extraordinarily important to actively encourage, incentivize people even to build those adjacent skill sets, because that lets them often solve problems and innovate holistically on things without recourse to anybody else. But it also builds an appreciation of the importance of certain other skill sets, which encourages people to go find those other people. I'll give you a really simple Skyscanner example again. I remember actively encouraging our marketing team, or our growth team as we called it, to learn how to code, not to professional engineering standards, just enough to, you know, automate some things. I remember when we first started talking about that, that was met with a lot of apprehension. You know, it's natural. And by the way, if you ask engineers to learn about digital marketing, you get at least as much apprehension. So it's the nature of these things. But I remember two young people from one of our country teams took a risk on learning Python. And having done so, they were then able to automate the creation of about 100,000 landing pages for the market. And we needed a lot of SEO landing pages because, you know, you type Edinburgh to Shanghai, you've got to have a landing page for that. And there's a lot of combinations. And what's on those, of course, makes a big difference to how they rank. So whereas previously marketing people would have built those by hand, you can imagine the quantums that they could do that in. And engineers wouldn't have even bothered because, well, that's marketing and we build product. The T-shapedness of those two young employees was extraordinarily valuable to the business. So I think that that T-shapedness is important. You've got to build that into your incentivization and encouragement in the organization. And that informal colliding of people is important. But also, you know, if you run any machine at 100%, it performs badly. You know, just try driving along the motorway in first gear, for example, see how long that lasts. It's important to give people a bit of space to explore things. And we're not good at that, but innovation will come from that.
We're really not good at that, particularly in a fast-growing startup for ourselves or our teams.
The T-shape part of it, I get that. Encouraging individuals to pick up other types of skills or knowledge, that seems useful. So got that part of it. The other part that I'm maybe more interested in is how do you as a CEO not just enable the individuals to pick up T-shaped skills, or really allow those individuals to gather in some form to make an innovation difference? Because obviously as an individual, you can only do so much. And if you're really going to create true innovation within the organization, you have to be working with others And if you have your structures around the functional, the cross-functional, and you're suggesting a third one, what are you really talking about then in terms of trying to collate those individuals together to do something useful?
Let's take the innovation question, and I think there's a related point on the task orientation. But if you take the innovation side of that, how do we help people do that? We've got to consider how hybrid working post-COVID influences some of this. But one of the first things I did in Skyscanner when I joined was essentially randomize the seating in the office. So we moved from having all the engineers here and all the marketing people here and all the salespeople on this floor to basically having groups of desks mixed in with other functions. So you'd have a desk of marketing people sitting next to a desk of engineers and so on and so forth. Also, when we started to grow to being more multi-site, we actively supported a budget for people moving and spending time on those other sites, you know, for different periods of time. It could be a month, it could be longer. All these sort of basic things that promote human contact. Another thing we did that was very valuable for us, extremely valuable, and this relates partly to the task question as well. We very actively embraced the squads and tribes model in the organization. And we crucially did something that many organizations fail to do, which we went all in on it. When I see squads and tribes fail, and you know, if people aren't familiar with squads and tribes who are listening, that the squad model is essentially saying, let's create small multifunctional teams of no more than eight people, which essentially resemble startups in that sense of scale. And you try to create an environment inside those squads, which is similar to a startup. Their ownership is clear. They have their own mission, KPIs, roadmap. They have all the skills they need to complete that task. So it's almost like a microcosm of our agency discussion. And you know, what we did when we put those squads together is we sat all the different people from different functions in the same squad, which people are very resistant to at first. You know, people feel an allegiance and an identity to their function, and that's the problem. So when they start to switch to feel an allegiance and identity to the squad and to the mission of the squad, then you start to get potentially dramatic productivity improvements. Now, you can't implement squads and tribes lightly. You can't, for example, implement it but have a code base which is monolithic and doesn't require teams to release independently. So there's always a significant adoption impact if you're doing it properly. But where I see it fail most often is because the hierarchy resists it. Because the people who feel most disturbed by squads and tribes are middle to senior managers who used to own not just management tasks, personal development, etc., but also the what. They only own the how, not the what. That makes people very nervous. So a lot of organizations will go halfway towards squads, and then nothing works halfway towards something. And then people say, well, it's not working, that's why we shouldn't do it. And they go back to functional dominance. There's plenty of ways to solve those apprehensions I talked about a second ago. But if you want squads and tribes to work, you have to go all in on it. And we did that.
Brandon and I both come from B2B backgrounds. So I'm thinking about like massive sales teams, massive marketing teams, rather than, I'm assuming Skyscanner was more B2C with like some partnership teams.
It was a mixture. I mean, we had like, you know, nowadays about 100 million active monthly users, but also we had a 1,500 business B2B partnerships, you know, with active integration. So it was a bit of both.
And so when you're talking about cross-functional, are you talking about cross-functional within the product team or cross-functional across the entire business? Because what I've seen in B2B businesses is pods work, sales, marketing, customer success, SDRs, but they're all ultimately around customer acquisition and retaining customers. And then the squads working with product developers, testers, but not one that has a salesperson and a product person and a developer together. So how cross-functional are you talking?
That's a very important question. And it varies across the organization depending on the focus of a given squad. So for example, in our product engineering efforts, most of the time that would consist of some engineers, product management, test person, data scientist, for example. It would vary, but that sort of skill set. As you moved into growth tribes, as we call them. So we basically would have a growth tribe for each major international region, you know, EMEA, APAC, Americas, and so on, not dissimilar to many other organizations. And where we went with that, and it was a journey, but where we went was those tribes would have in them, and within those tribes, you'd have a squad for, say, Japan and a squad for South Korea and so on, or for smaller markets, you know, a squad that looked after a few markets. And those squads would have a commercial person for that market, some marketing people of different flavors, contents and SEO, etc. And we also eventually had some engineers in that tribe as well. And to give you an example of why that was effective, if you're building a product, of course, the goal of product engineering is to build one product that can be adapted or configured for different markets. But what you tend to find is the mindset of those product engineering teams is to wish the world is the same everywhere. We are very good at believing what is convenient. So for many years in Skyscanner, we have people in the Japan market, South Korea, saying, this doesn't fit our market. That's not what web pages should look like in South Korea. That isn't how prices are displayed in Chile and so on. They're like, yeah, that's really interesting, but the rest of the world's more or less the same. So sorry, can't help you. And we're just too far away from the reality, you know, the sort of the visceral experience of a market. When we started to move to this model, we found that, for example, suddenly our South Korean performance went up by 300% because we did engineers close to this who were sitting with people who were having this problem and could adapt the product to be relevant to the, in this case, the South Korean market. Now, that created new problems about how do you handle those code bases. But, you know, quite often we have a discussion where, Brandon, you might say to Beth and I, we've got a big problem here, and if we did this, it would help it. And then I might say, ah, but that creates a new problem, Brandon. And then we'd immediately stop the discussion, as opposed to saying, is that new problem easier to solve than the original problem? So you know, you've got to follow the chain through and look at the benefit and the cost in each case. So we eventually did that, had dramatic results for us. So you have to be thoughtful about this, and you have to get there in stages, and you have to design it for your own organization. But I would urge people to at least open their minds to considering it. We don't consider it because the functional hierarchy is dominant. And in the early days of such a change, everybody's angry at the CEO because I don't want to sit over there with those guys and blah, 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 blah. You get a whole bunch of what sound like quite childish reasons, actually, for why people don't want to do this. But if you can break through that and stick with it, you can really have dramatic results. And I think what a CEO is supposed to do is not look for incremental improvement, is to believe that you can make things dramatically better and act with that mindset. And that tends to open up vistas you wouldn't otherwise consider.
I mean, it does seem like a lot of what you're talking about is areas that are probably pretty uncomfortable for COOs. So it's not around this is the new structure and this is the process that works. It's around taking your time to properly enable your teams and get out of the way. And that's always harder than here's a great OKR structure to roll out.
Absolutely. I think you put that really well. I think if you are thinking about it as you just described there, Beth, I'm here to put in a reasonable, logical structure and roll out the OKR process. You're not a COO. You're not a chief anything. You're a senior operations manager, and that's fine. We all will have to move through those stages. But CXO level, you're supposed to be transformational. Now, think about a growing company where, like in Skyscanner, you know, I used to feel that every 6 months I was in a different company because we were growing so quickly. Even to just keep the agency high of the organization, to justify hiring those new employees we hired, we had to innovate like crazy. And from the outside, it wouldn't have looked that different. We just had more customers, you know. But we had to change how the organization worked every year in a very significant way, you know, a transformative way, just to keep the agency high. So if you're not of that mindset that you're ready to do that, then the organization will leave you behind and they'll hire somebody else who has that mindset if they really are serious about success.
We're rapidly running out of time. We're coming up to the end of our discussion. We've covered a tremendous amount today. If our listeners were only going to take one thing away from the vast knowledge in your head, what is that one thing?
I would say whenever you change an organization, either wholesale or incrementally, ask yourself, is the agency of the frontline people higher after that change, the same or less, and use that to guide the organization. We don't tend to ask ourselves, what are we optimizing for when we change an organization? The way we do in other engineering endeavors, we should. So always optimize for agency when you're managing an organization change would be my takeaway.
Awesome. One more thing. Remind us of the four elements of agency, because some of us might not have always remembered, possibly, from the start to the end.
The four elements are investing in individual competence, being very clear on what people own, ensuring sufficient alignment, neither too much or too little, and ensuring access to the necessary resources to get the job done, which does not mean I need more people. It means I need the skill sets, complete way to get the job that I own done. So that would be the four in summary.
Lovely. So thank you, Mark Logan, for joining us on the Operations Room. And I will take the agency to close us off here. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a comment or subscribe, and we will see you next week.